You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy knows this, but our guest doesn't. And probably our listeners, if they're paying attention online, know this as well. My oven's baking element exploded and sprayed what Tracy and I believe to be probably wildly carcinogenic white powder inside everywhere. I have ordered the new element. The new element has come in, but I haven't put it in yet because I'm going to have to freaking like scrub the inside of that oven. And
you know
how difficult it is to find easy off oven cleaner these days? Like, it's not like King Soopers doesn't have it. The fuck?
Huh.
I had to get it somewhere else. Anyway, I haven't done that yet, so maybe that'll be a project. It's got to be a project if I'm going to do anything for Thanksgiving.
You have a deadline there.
I do have a deadline, yes.
It's a serious deadline. I mean, that's like my book is due levels of serious. One must eat on Thanksgiving.
So here's the thing. Like, I feel like I'm on a train about to crash because first, a random plate sitting in my cabinet cracked and broke without any intervention from me, which scared the shit out of me and my dog.
Okay, like, so witches.
We just heard this weird boom. Mm-hmm. And then it was hours before I figured out that it was the plate. Just a random like stoneware plate. And then my oven element explodes when I have turned it on to make a take and bake pizza, by the way, that I ended up cooking on the Traeger instead. Which was really, really good. It was good on the Traeger. Now I'm worried, like, what's next?
These things come in threes, you know.
What else is going to blow up? And by the way, that voice is Beth Cato. We've already been talking for like 2 minutes, Tracy. So I had.
I mean, probably introductions are in order. Yeah. Of course, when it comes to ovens and baking and all of that, Beth hardly needs any introduction. Although I will say, not that this is in any way outside your brand, because of course we've also had we had 1,000 Recipes for Revenge and other sorts of, like, there's always at least a little bit of a food element to a Beth Cato joint, as it were. But I need you to introduce me, Beth, and the listeners, of course, to the magical sourdough starter, because A House Between Sea and Sky. The words I was not expecting to encounter were magical sourdough starter. But then again, it's Beth Cato on the cover. I should have expected it. So, all right, let catch us up on this. This is wild.
Yeah, one of my characters is Mother. And Mother is an ancient, magical, perhaps divine sourdough starter. And she doesn't talk in words, but you know that she is involved, that she is emotionally involved, and she is able to converse with another one of my characters, which is the sentient house. But you don't see her side of the conversation. But Mother's, you know, her discard is used to create all kinds of baked goods, and those baked goods also have magical powers. They actually can cause regenerative healing powers, and they can even kind of make you feel better just being in the vicinity of a loaf of bread made from Mother. So she's a very powerful entity.
I pretty much always feel better in the vicinity of a loaf of bread, so I imagine that Mother-fueled vicinity of loaf of bread powers would have to be just like next level. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. And you know, have it nice and hot and, you know, nice crusty bread and add some good butter and all that. Oh, yeah, you're set.
This is probably a good point for me to say that Cannoli Joe, one of our regular listeners here, I'm sorry and not sorry for how hungry this episode is going to make you. This is just how it's going to be.
See, and I was already thinking about like the rolls that you get with like an Italian beef sandwich. Kind of flaky, and then you put the au jus on there and it's all good stuff. That's what I was thinking about as soon as you said bread.
Mm. You started making your plans for the day right there.
It's all difficult to get Italian beef that's good in Denver.
I can imagine.
I mean, everybody loves a good magical house, and apparently I'm going to fall in love with a good magical sourdough starter as well. But the house itself seems like maybe it's not as benevolent as Mother is, or at least it's maybe a little more complicated than Mother is here. So
yes.
can we kind of explore that premise a little bit?
Yeah, the house, which does have its own alternating chapters throughout the book, House has a very distinct childlike voice and is centuries old and has been a witch's house and has participated in some, I guess we can fairly say, some bloody murderous actions in the past. And its oven has definitely seen diverse meat dishes inside.
Oh.
Okay. However, the house wasn't necessarily a willing participant in this. It was doing its job. Mm-hmm. And had a witch to please. And sometimes when you have a boss who asks things of you, you do what the boss asks. But now the house, as the book begins, has no witch and has been abandoned. And is pretty much stuck on a seaside cliff in Carmel by the Sea, California, in 1926. And it's lonesome. It's kind of been dozing for a long time because it doesn't know what else to do. And it's very lonesome and it's, you know, you begin to realize it's starting to assert more of its true nature mm-hmm. through the course of the book.
So 1926 is a really interesting time stamp to put on this for the book. And I have to imagine it's not entirely driven by the desire to fend off the soil erosion that would make this now a bottom of the sea house here. So, but why 1926?
I chose that for a very specific reason. There is a guest star in the middle of the book. There is a very famous person who makes a cameo appearance. Mm. And the entire book is structured around that person making an appearance. So they have a very specific timeline. It is what happens to them is very public, very chronicled in movies, books, TV series, everything. I had lots of material drawn, and the entire book is built around that person showing up.
All right. I have a theory, but we're going to have to talk about that off air, so to speak, because clearly we don't want to spoil anything here.
Yeah.
Certainly not the starter. All right. So this is a question for like both of you, because I'm curious. I was listening to a entirely different podcast recently.
There's
and
another
it was talking one or two, I think, maybe. Yeah.
News to me.
No. And it was talking about a phenomenon that I wasn't really aware of. And so now I've kind of Googled around and gone like, huh, this is a thing. And this being a witch's house has put me in mind of it. Apparently, there is a thriving economy on Etsy of hiring Wiccans to cast spells for you.
Yes, I have read about that in relation to certain recent political events.
All right. So, okay, I am kind of curious about this from an us perspective, right? All right. So you're going to go on Etsy and you're going to hire a Wiccan to cast an enchantment on your behalf. Apparently they run anywhere from like $5 to like a couple hundred, depending on what said enchantment is for. Assuming that the money is not an object here. What kind of enchantment are we searching for here? I don't know. Top choices of enchantments, folks. Patrick, how about for you?
Obviously, I need something to protect me from the household goods and appliances in my house.
Yes. A ward against household mishap.
Yeah.
I mean, you may have a ghost or some kind of infestation of a spiritual nature, it sounds like.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Oh, you know what the three was? The thing with your elbow where your stairs tried to kill you.
Twice.
Yeah. So, I mean, the order of operations is actually different there, but I think you got your three. I think you're okay now.
Three?
Yeah, that's my theory. Yeah.
Still a little swollen, but it's fine.
Ooh. No, okay.
It's not the color of night anymore like it was for a little while.
the color of darkness.
Tracy was basically, you know, she did the normal, responsible human adult thing, which is you need to go to the doctor. And I did the normal growing up, never having gone to the doctor because we couldn't afford a thing of it's not bleeding. Like it's.
I'm going to put a bag of peas on it.
little kerosene on there and it'll be fine.
Wait, no. Do people do that? Do people put kerosene on injuries?
Of course. Oh, yeah. It kills whatever's ailing you.
Also honey. But honey actually is proven to have, you know, like Manuka honey, things like that. Yeah. You can put on injuries. It helps them to heal.
Well, honey I heard of, but like kerosene is like what?
Yeah, you have a cut. You just dip it in the kerosene to kill it.
Jesus. Oh.
Doesn't feel good, I think.
No, yeah. I just felt a wave of pain at the suggestion.
Y'all ain't never been there before, have you?
I guess not. It must be happening down on the holler. So Beth, what enchantment are you paying for on Etsy?
Okay, kind of building off what was already said, and because I am also an American, healthcare.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yes, you know.
Healthcare security.
Healthcare security, you know, stay well, you know, let's cure the cancer, let's, you know, heal the injury, let's stop the migraine headaches on a personal note, you know, things like that.
Oh, so you're casting big. This isn't just a like, let's fix Beth's migraines. This is like, let's heal the contiguous. Let's make sure Hawaii and Alaska get in there too. So all 50 states, we're gonna
let's help the people. I mean, I'm not be selfish about this. I mean, if this stuff works, by golly, let's do some good in the world.
I saw something that is Beth related slightly. This is baking, and I always associate baking with Beth. But the idea that this holiday season, instead of making gingerbread dolls, if you're baking, bake voodoo dolls, and then at least you can put them to good use as you're breaking off the legs and feet.
Oh,
well, I've been doing that since I was a kid. I guess I was hipster about it. Doing it before was cool, but yeah, okay. I'm imagining this, you know, little gingerbread figures. Yeah, bite the head off first. Always bite the head off first for me.
Well, particularly if you've got that type of Thanksgiving get together where there's a couple of relatives who you kind of really need to be there because it's just the mores of the family, but also they're sort of a problem. Like maybe you're going to have a couple of like Uncle Stewart, you know, gingerbread voodoo things going on for like, I invited him, but he twisted his ankle. He's not coming.
That's like a thing with jelly babies. What do you bite off first? Like there's like a thing, like, do you go for the head first? Do you go for the body first? Like, what do you do?
Well, and people question that, like there's a pathology involved. Like what kind of person are you if you bite the head off first or the leg or an arm?
Yeah.
Left arm versus right arm, you know?
Yeah, we're getting into the whole Lilliputian argument and, you know, what are we doing with our eggs here?
Well, don't put them all in one basket. I've heard that.
Oh, no. In this economy, no.
First off, can you even afford that basket?
Oh, every time I buy some eggs, I take a picture and put it online, almost like a Tinder kind of thing. Hey, look at this. I can afford eggs.
You could put this in your profile. It'd be like, excellent provider of eggs.
Well, you know, eggs have dropped in price. What's killing me right now is the price of chocolate. Have you seen the price of chocolate these days? Even at Aldi, you're looking at going toward $4 a bag for chocolate chips at Aldi.
Yeah.
Like almost doubled. I think it's about doubled in price in the past year and a half or so.
No, and I would 100% believe your accounting on that because you are the queen of keeping track of the stuff in Aldi there. Like if I want to know what's worth having, I'm going to check my socials and see what Beth's gotten from Aldi.
Heck yeah. I mean, yesterday I was sharing a picture of the Wisconsin cheese advent calendar I found at Aldi.
Okay.
That was just yesterday.
So, okay. I feel like this is a dumb question because you all of the words that you use there are very clear nouns together. Wisconsin cheese advent calendar. I mean, Wisconsin in this case used as an adjective, but whatever. But like, I'm assuming if anybody's done a cheese advent calendar before, it would be you, yeah?
Oh yeah. I've done several different ones, yeah. But this was a brand new one.
All right. Okay. So you pop open a door on a cheese advent calendar. What's your like? The cheese that you're like, ah, dang. Is there a cheese that you're like,
that's your question?
It's not that you won't eat it, but it's like,
my question was, do you have to keep the cheese advent calendar in the fridge?
Yes.
If it's good cheese, you better keep it in the fridge.
All of the ones that I've seen, because they do have a mix of cheeses, you do tend to refrigerate them. Now, not all cheeses need to be refrigerated. If it's dried, if it's aged, it's fine without that. But usually with the mix involved here, you wouldn't want to do that. For me, there are definitely cheeses I don't like. You're talking about spicy cheeses.
Okay.
I don't do those
habanero sort of things.
No, I will die. I will die, and it'll be like Edward Gorey woman on the gravestone at the beginning of the mystery, going, and that'll be me dying of the spicy cheese. And I also don't like truffle cheeses.
Oh, okay. I don't like mushrooms generally, so I would be with you on that one.
See, and I like mushrooms, but for some reason, truffle flavor is just foul to me, and I don't know why.
See, I've started, and I know we're having a cheese conversation now.
But, I was here. You had to go to cheese.
I have started really liking Tillamook.
Oh yeah.
I don't like the one I think you like, the Irish one, Derry. Kildare?
Kerrygold?
Yeah, Kerrygold Dublin. Well, Kerrygold, that's the brand. Dubliner is the most well-known one.
I've tried those, and I don't like them for some reason. But I'm liking the Tillamook, so I keep buying that.
Well, and that's fine. I mean, you have huge regional variations in cheddar cheese alone. Like, huge. Yeah. In the case of Kerrygold, I can geek out on this, sorry. But their cows feed on grass, and it's a different color of butter because of that. And it's a different flavor. To me, it's a chalky note that is specific in their cheeses. Mm-hmm. And Tillamook is very different coming from the Oregon coast because they have a co-op that they pull their milk.
It's the flavor. There. It's the flavor. I just like it better. And it melts better, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, and in Wisconsin, regionally, you have different areas of Wisconsin. You get different flavors. And Vermont is known for having very sharp, tangy cheeses. It's kind of their regional terroir.
I was born in Chicago, and I have Chicago Bears DNA in me. I cannot buy cheese or anything else from Wisconsin.
Okay. I understand. I know there's a big rivalry there, being that I'm now in the upper Midwest, and I see Charlie Bear and stuff, and he's very anti-Chicago. So.
Oh, well, see, As a born and raised Chicago area person myself, I have utterly no problem accepting cheese from my northern neighbors. Yes, we will have a cheese exchange economy. It is fine.
Yeah, I mean, and you have the Cheese Castle like right there north of the border. It's kind of a shame to miss out on that kind of glory when it's right there.
Yeah, I'm a pragmatist when it comes to these sorts of things. Like, I'm going to stand on principle when there's good cheese to be had.
Yeah. There are times to draw a line and times when you say, no, there's no line. If it's good, it's good. Enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Can't support anything that supports Packers. Sorry.
All right. So we get the spicy cheese. You're sending it to Patrick.
Oh, God, please.
When you pop open that door.
I love the spicy cheese.
All right. Well, there you go. By your powers now, combined, you can finish the advent calendar.
See, I'm thinking if I get a Dice advent calendar again this year, I'll just keep it in the fridge, too.
I mean, what if, hang on, we make this work. What if it's a Dice advent calendar, but all the dice are cheese?
They actually make that.
Yeah. I've been tagging that meme so many times.
Yeah.
And they're even stored in a little brie box. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go. That would be the move.
But I think if you just use those to roll in your game, eventually they'd get really gross.
Oh yeah. It would be. Yeah. No one actually should be using those for the design purpose.
I would just for a bit. Absolutely show up at a game just for a bit and start rolling those and just gross people out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if you roll a one or something, you know, on the 20 there, the only solution is you just got to eat that guy. There's no dice jail for it. You're like, no, this is your punishment. Yeah. You're just going down now. Yeah. So, okay. Recently, Patrick, you were at Mile High Con, and we've been talking some about the kind of like post-con, I guess, no redundancy intended, high of energy and whatnot that comes after that. And I tend to think, when I tend to think about cons and authors who I see at cons and are well-beloved at them, I think of Beth a lot too. So I kind of want to unpack con things. Beth, have you been to any cons in the last year or so? How's that scene been for you?
Yeah, I've been to 4th Street Fantasy, and then I actually went to Worldcon in Seattle this year.
All right. So I have not been to 4th Street, but I hear things about it. So can you tell the listeners about what 4th Street is?
Yeah, 4th Street has a very different vibe from any other con I've been to. It's very intimate. You have only a couple hundred people. They're all tend to be very experienced authors. I know like Scott Lynch, Elizabeth Baer, they're very involved with the organization. So you have, you know, just wonderful known people that are involved with it. And it's just, you have one panel track. Mm-hmm. So everyone goes to it and hangs out. And then you have big meal breaks. And then they have meal guides where they're all going to a certain restaurant nearby. And there are gobs of restaurants in the vicinity. So it's really great for socializing, and you're not, it's not like, I say, at Worldcon where you have 20 different tracks and there are people who are like, oh, so-and-so is going to be there. I want to see them. And you never see them.
Yeah.
Because there's just too much going on. Mm-hmm. It's really nice at 4th Street. It's very easy to talk to people. It's very easy to hang out. You can get whatever food you want. You can socialize. The 2 years that I've been going there, they have a very strict masking policy. Mm-hmm. So everyone is masked unless you are socializing at a meal, which makes it feel a whole lot safer than Worldcon with all the masses involved there. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a, so it's a very friendly con for people who are being extra cautious still and who have disabilities to attend, which I love. And it's just, it's a different vibe. It feels very, it edges toward academic, but it's approachable. But I feel like I learn about craft when I'm there on a deeper level because it's such a good conversation.
Yeah. That description reminds me of ReaderCon to some extent. Like, I feel like there's going to be a little bit of a Venn diagram overlap there.
Yeah, and I've heard good things about ReaderCon like that, too.
That's fantastic. So where's 4th Street? Where
it is in Minneapolis.
Okay. All right. Which, yeah. Good town, too. Nice place to find yourself.
I mean, it's a drive for me that should be an hour, but because it's on the opposite side of the metropolitan area, it is not a pleasant drive. And since I don't drive in city traffic at all, my poor husband has had to drive me to and from, and he's earned his apple pies as reward, I will tell you, for having to deal with traffic on my behalf.
No one will say that Mr. Beth goes unfed. That's for sure. So well done, Mr. Beth. So Patrick, can you catch the listeners up a little bit on Mile High Con, which is not quite that same vibe. It's a different kind of scope and scale.
So Mile High Con is a literary science fiction convention, obviously. Like they do focus on books, but they don't want to focus on craft. They don't want to become a writers' conference, right? We have Pikes Peak writers here. We have Rocky Mountain fiction writers. Those are where you go to kind of learn craft. But they will do a little bit of writerly kind of things because writers keep asking for it, you know. So there tends to be some sort of track like that. But they purposely try to limit it. I don't know how many people come anymore because I don't involve myself with the con business on purpose. But I will say that it was like super crowded on Saturday. They are like, anyone can wear a mask if they want to, but they don't require it. But I will say, like, this is one of the few years I've gone and I did not get sick. And I was there all 3 days. And it was good. It was fun. I got to see a bunch of people, like you said, like that I normally wouldn't see. And hang out and talk and be on panels with people. And that's always fun. One thing I was curious about, because this, if you're in an area, you tend to see lots of conventions happen at the same hotel. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, they moved Mile High Con to a new hotel. It's actually funny because the previous hotel and the new hotel are equal distance from me because I have this giant Cherry Creek Reservoir thing between me and civilization. And so I can either way, I have to go around it somehow by getting on the interstate essentially. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's 15 minutes this way or 15 minutes that way. But the new hotel is also where Genghis Khan was, which was the gaming convention that I went to in February. And when I was there in February, the hotel would not allow any outside food or drink. Like they were very enforcing that. And so when you came in, they had a little snack area where you could buy whatever you wanted and take it in. They didn't want you bringing something in yourself. So I was expecting that same vibe at Mile High Con. And for whatever reason, the hotel wasn't doing that. So I don't know if it's the con doing it. Maybe the con's getting a cut. I don't know how that worked, but I've always been curious because I know like one time Mary Robinette Kowal got busted for serving drinks at WorldCon because she does this thing where she would give shots to people who like asked or answered a question or something like that.
Yeah.
And that violated the hotel's no outside food or drink policy that was written into the contract for WorldCon. And she was very upfront about it. She's like, oh, shit, I didn't know. I'm so sorry. Like, and you know, so she got in trouble. I'm always curious, Beth, like, do you ever have to check before you bring – like, because a lot of times you'll bake cookies or you'll bake, like, cookie bars or something, mm-hmm. and you'll take it to the con. Do you ever have to check and see if that's cool or if they're going to bust you?
I haven't done that with the big cons. When I was going to CocoCon in Phoenix, which sadly the – that con is no more, but it was really an awesome small con in the area. I did check with them. They had me as their local guest author the first year. So I knew the con runners really well and sure. talked to them. And they said, you know, there was a hotel policy that the food could only be served in the con suite. Mm-hmm. So what I did started to do then was I only gave it away in the con suite. And then after COVID shutdowns, when cons were starting to pick up again, what I did was I would wrap one cookie or two cookies in plastic wrap. Mm-hmm. So that way, if everyone was masking, then here's a cookie, take it and enjoy it in the safety and privacy of your own room.
Sure.
And I continued that with WorldCon mm-hmm. this past year, you know, just well, a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked really well because if people wanted to stay cautious in public, then they could just put it in their bag and have it. Or if they were hungry, they could have it right then.
Sure.
And it worked out for everyone in that way. And that way, you know, I feel like I'm not, if there is a restriction, I'm not violating it because it's packaged to go.
Sure. Yeah. Tracy mentioned like the energy of a con. Because I keep talking about it. Like I went to Mile High Con and it's been slow for me to go back to cons.
Yeah.
For lots of different reasons. But I go to Mile High Con and this year I was there all 3 days. I spent a lot more time there. I saw tons of people. I interacted with them. I was on 4 panels, 5 panels, something like that, which surprised me because I wasn't expecting to be on that many panels. I would have been good with 1 or 2, mm-hmm. but they were very kind and they put me on more. And I think that also comes from, you know, if you're a good attendee, a good panelist, like you come there and you bring good energy and like they reward that and they put you on more stuff. So I think that's part of it. But there's just this energy mm-hmm. that you come mm-hmm. back with from a con. Do you feel that? Like when you come back from a con, do you just feel like energized and thinking about all the things you want to do and that kind of stuff? And
well, I am a late diagnosed autistic person. And I do a con and I kind of get turned on. I am so introverted. And I get kind of turned on to being this overstimulated introvert for days because I'm actually talking with people other than my cats all day. And I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm exploring. And then I get home and I'm typically completely overwhelmed by everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it may not be uncommon if I need to do extra naps in the coming days. And then I'm kind of overwhelmed with getting back home. It doesn't even matter if I'm gone a week or if I'm gone a day. I feel like, oh my goodness, I'm behind on everything I need to do at home. So I come back from a con feeling high, overwhelmed, maybe sad because I'm missing people, I'm missing a place, but it's kind of coming, it's this whole mix of overstimulation that I have to kind of work through in the days that follow.
Yeah, one of the things that for me, I used to, before I had a dog, I used to get a room at the hotel.
Mm. Oh, that's, yeah.
And I would, you know, I also get overstimulated. And I get overwhelmed. And then what I would do is I would, at that moment, I would head to my room.
Yes.
And kind of break that a little bit and try to, and I didn't have that this time. And I haven't had that in a little while because I, you know, I got the dog now and he's like, he's a spaz and he doesn't do well with others sometimes. And so like, I don't want to, he doesn't do a crate and I don't want to put him in a kennel. So I tend to go back and forth.
Yeah.
And so I had several moments at this con where it's like all of a sudden I'm just realizing I need to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I would go off and find a little corner and kind of sit for a minute and drink my Gatorade that I brought with me and just chill out for a second before I would go back. So I get that. But it's kind of funny because it didn't happen when I got home. Like I didn't still feel overstimulated, but I did have this energy. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately started bothering Tracy about podcast shit.
That's what one does.
Yeah.
I think maybe the difference between those two experiences, other than like all human beings are different and are wired differently and have different needs is like, if you're kind of in a position where you're able to maintenance that feeling of overwhelm along the way, like your schedule is a little friendlier for it, your awareness of when you need it and your ability to disengage with people is a little bit, you know, more conducive. You know, I imagine that one reaches a certain level of visibility and fame and whatnot, that it doesn't matter if you've hit your overwhelm peak. Like, if people see you, they're coming for you. Like, oh, how are you? And like, want to talk to you. And so I think that how much of it that you're able to manage in the moment versus how much of it is just kind of like accreting over time, yeah. You know, and then you have that kind of crash that has to happen eventually, whether it happens at the end of a day in the room or once you're finally home. Yeah.
It does help to have a hotel room to retreat to. That's something that is very important. One con I was not able to really utilize that well was the one time I went to Gen Con.
Gen Con.
And the hotel for the writers was way on the outskirts of Indianapolis because the con books up the entire city. It is absolutely massive.
And there's a lottery for the rooms.
Yeah, it's hard to get rooms. I was lucky to get in with the writer's block. So I felt fortunate to get that, but it was like a 30-40 minute drive on a shuttle to get there and back.
Yeah, once so you're on the con, you're just there.
Yeah, so there was no going back in the middle of the day. It was you go there in the morning, you come back in the evening, and that was it. It was awesome that year. They had a really good green room. Mm-hmm. And it was a very good space where if you wanted to, you could go into a corner and climb under a tablecloth and just kind of zone out like a cat, you know, and everything was cool. So that did, the green room helped a lot. I leaned on that, but that was a very hard con for me to work. It really was because it took a lot out of me. And then to make it worse, my flight leaving was changed. It was like the flight left at like 5 a.m.
Ugh. Oh no.
So instead of leaving at like 7, it was a big change. So I had to get up like 2:30 a.m. to pack. And that was a rough day.
I had a similar spread out experience with Reno, Rocon Reno.
Oh, okay.
Because they were spread out over so many hotels. Like there was no one thing. And so they had shuttles going between all the hotels to kind of move people around. And I did not like that at all. It was very difficult because you're basically getting on a shuttle and like the shuttle was jumping on like expressways and stuff to go between different hotels. And yeah, it was, I did not like that. I did not like that at all.
I think one of the other problems with those cons that get so big that they have to kind of distribute themselves across all of that territory is you don't really have a chance to experience the city.
No.
You'd think that you would because you have to get from A to B and there's meaningful distance between them, but you're just so focused on needing to get from A to B that they're almost never the type of experience where it's like, ah, I'm just going to walk outside and walk down the street and experience some of that. Like, no, like it's just kind of a zoo of activity and commuting pressure and so on. So yeah, that is definitely one of the unfortunate side effects of those.
I try to find blocks of time if I'm traveling to a city where I get to go out and explore and not do con. Like, you know, being in Seattle, it was very important to me. I was determined to get down to Pike Place Market, not on a weekend, and go to the cheese shops that were down there and get some good aged cheeses that I knew I could transport without refrigeration back to Minnesota. So I worked that in. In the past, when Worldcon was in Kansas City, I did a really lovely little half day and I went down to the World War One Museum, which was absolutely wonderful. Highly recommend that. Mm-hmm. And that involved even doing a trolley through downtown, through a drag there. So I try if I can work it, you know, cause like you were saying with getting lots and lots of panels, that can be very exhausting. It's ideal to me if I have one or two panels a day and then I have a half day here and there where I can just hang out with friends or go to a museum or go explore and go to a food destination I really want to go to and all that. It really matters and it makes me feel like I'm getting to experience the place, but
yeah,
you know, sometimes it's hard, you know, to try and find the balance there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you want to hit that Waffle House and see what's different about Waffle House in Seattle versus, you know, Tennessee.
Could be different.
It's not.
Yeah.
The one thing that Tracy and I kind of always chat about, usually in Messenger, but is like there was this muscle that you worked. And especially for me, like when I first started going to cons, I had a driven goal that I was going to be more extroverted and I was going to push myself to do this. And I got kind of good at it where I could go and I could be, as Donardo used to say at SF Signal, he's like, I can see when you turn the podcaster on, like there's an actual like flip in you when you do that and you become more extroverted. And I did that for years and years. And then, you know, mom getting sick and then COVID and then not going to cons for such a long time and then trying to go back. It's like that muscle is gone. It didn't atrophy. It's just gone. And it's really hard for me, at least, to get at that con. And like I have a hard time making eye contact with people now when I'm at a con. So a lot of times I'll be looking like at them, but I'm also kind of looking over them. You know,
it's weird.
And it kind of bugs me that I can't just do that again. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you have any experience with that? Like, is it harder for you to go back to cons now after like post COVID or?
I was a bit worried about that too. I think I am more sensitive to being around crowds now, much more so. And especially in big crowds, like in the airport and things like that, where I don't mask everywhere I go these days, but when I'm in big crowds like the airport or on planes, oh my goodness, yes. So I find that if I am having to be among crowds like that and I'm needing to mask up, that is extra exhausting to me. And I don't know, maybe the part of that is physical with just having to wear it and, you know, maybe slightly restricted breathing and just kind of the vibe around that. But I also think I'm just more exhausted by people in general.
We are exhausting. We are.
Yeah. Well, I know I can be exhausting. So, I mean, that's just how it is.
Tracy also knows that I can be exhausting. So,
I mean, yes. Yeah. So that's fair. So before we're all exhausted, considering the timing of this particular guest spot and considering who our guest is, I feel like I would be doing a pretty bad job of seizing the moment if we didn't talk a little bit about what's going to be on the menu for Thanksgiving in Shea Cato. So I want to, but not so much like putting you on the spot for like name all the dishes. I want to put this in like the kind of, and we can all weigh in on this, but sort of like this or that type of thing. So, all right. Okay. All right. So dark meat or white meat kind of gal?
I'm fine with either.
Yeah. Okay. Just give me the meats. All right.
Yeah.
How about you, Patrick?
I am a white meat turkey person, but I will say I love turkey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I eat turkey all freaking year.
Yeah.
Like when
that's
I go, when I go to King Supers, I go to the deli and I get sliced turkey and that's my sandwiches during the week. I just love turkey. I've always loved turkey. And it's hilarious because when I had a job that I had to go to the office and, after Thanksgiving, I would still go to like a sandwich shop and I would get a turkey sandwich. And they're like, really, turkey? Like Thanksgiving was yesterday. Yeah, I know.
Get turkey.
So,
that's good. Why not? Yeah. I mean, I'm all about the leftovers too. I mean, give me a nice turkey wild rice soup. And I have like perfected a recipe for using leftover turkey to do mini pot pies.
Yes, I do.
And it is like the best thing in the world. It is so good. I have this Pampered Chef pan that has 6 holes for doing little mini pot pies. Nice. And they are the best thing ever.
See, I would do fantastic. One. I'd do a giant pot pie. I would do like a big giant pot pie with turkey. But the other thing I've discovered when you talk about the dark meat is I have a dog.
Mm.
You have discovered that you have a dog. That's true.
Yes. And when I have all that leftover turkey, I give a bunch of it to him.
Mm.
And then I have really pleasant, calm evenings as he's snoring. Yeah. It's wonderful.
The powers of tryptophan. Yes. There you go. All right. So in terms of sidekicks to the turkey, stuffing or dressing, which, as people who are pedantic about these things recognize the differences, did it originate from within the bird or is it beside the bird? So stuffing or dressing?
Well, my answer for that is two-tier. First of all, dressing, because that's what I was raised with always. Sure, sure. And secondly, it is a very important safety consideration where sometimes with stuffing, you have issues where it does not cook through all the way and can actually be an illness issue for people in the aftermath.
Right. Right.
But yeah, I love dressing. One of my first things I learned to bake was my grandma's dressing recipe, which has since been retired with her death because everyone actually preferred the dressing that I made after it.
Oh, no.
But yeah. Well, my grandma's recipe had olives in it and things like that. Like my husband does not eat olives or mushrooms or anything like that. So I have a cornbread dressing that I do from scratch that has pecans and cranberries in it. And it's really good.
Nice. So I think I already know the answer for this one for you, Patrick, but
I do cornbread dressing.
Oh, there we go.
I don't do fancy. I would consider like cranberries and stuff like that fancy.
Oh, okay.
But it is mom's recipe and I still make it. And what's funny is I don't like dressing, but I still make it and I still eat it because it's Thanksgiving.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. It is the ritual of the thing.
But I also, I make it in the pan that I cook the turkey in.
Okay, so you got the drippings.
I use the drippings and stuff. But yeah, I will make the cornbread first. I will do the celery and the onion, and I've got all the spices and stuff. And yeah, I put it all together and cook it from scratch.
I guess I'm a dressing gal, but I call it stuffing because I'm lazy. And then I don't have to worry about people not understanding what I'm talking about. I do it with tart apples and cranberries and pecans in it. And I'm the only one in my family who actually wants it or eats it. But that's fine. Yep. I will, as leftovers, when we get to the point that there's nothing but gravy and dressing left, that's cool. I'm going to have a bowl of gravy and dressing for dinner and the rest of y'all can just spin.
See, I will make a Dagwood. I'll make a Dagwood. And I'll use the dressing for a Dagwood sandwich. Yeah.
That works. That works.
In the years when we were doing the drive, when we lived in Arizona, we worked it out so I could drive back to my parents' house every year for Thanksgiving, which is absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. But one thing I would do was with the leftover dressing was it is so good. It is even good cold.
Yeah.
So like when we were doing the long day's drive going from Hanford, California to Buckeye, Arizona, we'd be going through the desert and I would be with my lunch, I'd be eating the cold dressing and it was absolutely delicious.
When you were going through the desert, just fine. When you were going through the desert, was it on a horse?
I know what you're about
to
do. I knew you were going to do it, Patrick Louis.
You know, it's funny you say, I heard that song on the radio yesterday.
Yeah.
And I was like, it is so weird. I have not heard this song in forever. And then you mentioned it today. Just one of those weird universe things.
The radio knew Patrick was coming.
Yeah. Apparently, yeah.
All right.
It's because I was standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona.
Such a fine sight to see.
All right. I could go on forever with my Thanksgiving questions here.
One more.
Okay. Yeah. Do we want it to be another side dish question? Do we want it to be a dessert question?
I have a side.
You go.
I have one.
Yeah.
Sweet potatoes or yams?
I'm not big on either, honestly. Growing up, it was always the canned yams covered with marshmallows and round top. And I would eat the marshmallows off.
No, that's disgusting.
No, that was my thing. My husband doesn't do that. So
you're disqualified, Tracy.
Sweet potatoes. I like them with butter and brown sugar and just a little bit of cinnamon on top. Yeah. Little bit of salt.
Marshmallow does not belong in food. Marshmallow is just terrible. It should not be anything. I do yams. I do the canned yams, but I cook them with brown sugar and butter.
My mom added a lot of brown sugar.
Well, we add more. And it's so good. And I am it's just like with you in the dressing, Tracy. Mm. I'm the one who wants that. I'm the one who likes that.
You do you, boo. Like, if that's the way you want it, you apologize to no one.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do your dessert one for back.
Okay. All right. So in my household growing up, my mom, the great burden that she faced, and my dad too, actually, because my mom was a really good cook, but my mom was a really good baker, but she was a terrible cook. My dad is kind of an indifferent baker, but a really good cook. So by their powers combined, we could make Thanksgiving happen. And when it came to pies, no one could agree. And so we were always stuck with three pies in a four-person household because I loved apple, my brother demanded pecan, and my dad really wanted either pumpkin or mincemeat. Pumpkin if it was Thanksgiving, mincemeat was the changeover when it became Christmas. So what I want to know is what's your pie?
Well, I do. My husband loves apple pie. That is like what he wants for his birthday. I mean, so he can have apple pie whenever. And then we always do that at Christmas. But Thanksgiving is always about pumpkin.
Got it.
We do love pecan pie, too, though. But for Thanksgiving, pumpkin is the tradition. I have a recipe I'm wanting to try out this year that's from a magazine. I think it's bourbon vanilla pumpkin. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how hopefully that turns out.
Nice. Nice. Patrick?
I agree with Beth on the pumpkin pie, which is why every year I make banana pudding.
But pudding's good.
I love banana pudding.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So,
do you do no wafers?
No.
No?
I make it the right way. So, I will get a pumpkin pie from the store because I'm not going to make a pie. But I will make from scratch banana pudding. And the way that I was taught was my grandmother's way, which my mom did. And it has no vanilla wafers in it. It's graham crackers.
So that sounds good too.
Yeah, you crush up graham crackers and you make a layer. And you don't do butter or anything. You just make a layer of graham cracker crumbs. And then you put your pudding and then your banana. And then you do another layer. And then you're putting in a banana and another
trifle.
And layer it that way.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, it does sound like a trifle. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's funny is I've always made it that way. Mom always made it that way. Graham's always made it that way. My aunt, her husband, my uncle, loves that banana pudding. And I'm not allowed to take it to their house because my aunt doesn't like anyone bringing anything over that he will eat that she hasn't made because she needs to be the only cook.
Because we need to impede joy. This is important.
This is the same aunt. This is the same aunt who goes, "I remember what you like," and hands me a big fucking thing of marshmallow covered sweet potatoes, where I'm like, "This is disgusting. You hate me. Go away."
Aww. This sounds like it was traumatic for you. I mean, we're delving some deep issues here.
It was funny. So I used to work for them.
Are the marshmallow-covered yams in the room with you right now?
No. I used to work for them and they in Fresno, and we always these open houses, right? We always did these open houses where all the customers would come in and we would feed them. And one of the things that we would do is we would feed them at Thanksgiving, like we would do this Thanksgiving thing. And the first year I was there, my aunt is talking about how she's doing all the cooking for the Thanksgiving, and I'm like, "Oh, that's great." And she's like, "Yeah, we're going to have this and that." And she mentioned sweet potatoes. I said, "Oh, sweet potatoes are my favorite." She's like, "Well, you're the only one. No one ever eats them. I end up throwing them all out." I said, "Well, that's just crazy. I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't eat the sweet potatoes." And then I found out why.
Why?
Yeah. Because what she was doing was she would get cans of yams, right? And she would put them in a big thing, and then she would pour like a gallon of orange juice on them and mash them up. And that's what she thought sweet potatoes were, because someone had taught her that at some point. Like,
oh, no.
And so the next year I said, "Can I help with the food?" And she said, "Sure. What do you want to do?" And I said, "I would like to make the yams." And she's like, "Oh, okay." And I made them my way. And they were all eaten.
Mm.
And then the next year, I was not allowed to make them.
Whoa, that got personal.
Vindictive Yams, which, by the way, would be an amazing metal band name. I just going to throw that out there.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, now that I feel like we need a palate cleanser of a pick of the week after that unfortunate demise of the yams.
We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
All right, Patrick, you don't get your yams, but you're going to get your pick of the week.
Yeah, Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out. She'd scour the pots and scrape the pans, spice the hams, and candy the yams. My my pick this week is got nothing to do with food. It's a show on Apple TV called Down Cemetery Road. And if you're unfamiliar with this, it is starring Emma Thompson and Ruth Wilson. And Emma Thompson is a private investigator. Ruth Wilson is a woman who is having dinner with family and friends when there's a massive explosion that like takes out a window in her house. And this is like in London or somewhere. And she becomes obsessed with this child that was the lone survivor of this explosion at this house. And no one will talk to her about the child. The police say, stay away from it. The hospital won't let her see the child, won't let her leave a card for the child. And she's like, what is going on? And so she ends up hiring these private investigators to look into it. It's based on a book by Mick Herron. And this is the same author who wrote Slow Horses, which is another show on Apple TV that I really, really like. And it's kind of got the same vibe a little bit. You know, the older Emma Thompson is like the older private investigator who doesn't take shit anymore. And she says what she thinks and, you know, has zero filters, but she's really, really good at her job. And it's got a slow start and like a slow burn to it, but there's just so much kind of going on and it's really, really intense and interesting. As these two women are trying to figure out like what's going on and why is this child's like survival such a secret, even to the point where like one of them, Ruth notices, her character notices that like a picture has been edited to remove the child from the photo and then put in the press. And so like there's this mystery going on and it's really good. So Down Cemetery Road on Apple TV.
All right. Very cool. So, Beth, what's your pick?
Well, I have a new very favorite author. And she is not someone that I know personally or have interacted with, but I am like now hardcore fangirl for her stuff. Meg Schaefer, who started out with The Wishing Game a few years ago, which is not, it's not a speculative fiction book, but it is a love letter to the way that children's literature can help children survive the horrors of childhood. And it is a tearjerker. It is emotional. It is beautiful. And then her second book is called The Lost Story. And it's kind of a queer Narnia take. And it is really good. Again, really great feels, fantastic characters, surprises. So good. And then her third book is out next year. And I was able to score an advanced galley off of NetGalley. Which just, I literally like did this Kermit. I was so excited to get this book. And it's called The Book Witch. And it starts out slow. I was thinking, oh, this isn't as good as the previous books. But then it got going. Oh my goodness. It is so good. It is about a witch who can travel into the worlds of books. And she's battling against these nefarious burners who go into trying to destroy books and destroy characters. But there's so much more going on, and it turns into such a good book through the end. It's really good. So I highly recommend all three books from Meg Schaefer, including the one that's out next year.
Very cool.
Fantastic. All right. So that's a lot to look forward to. My pick is about food, or at least it very intimately involves food. A tradition that I've had going for almost 2 years now with my daughter has been watching The Great British Baking Show.
Yay!
And so the Great British Baking Show's final episode of season 16, or what Netflix would call collection 13, just dropped. We are currently recording this on the 8th of November, so it just dropped yesterday. So we watched the final episode. We laughed, we gasped, we rooted. And this particular season of it, again, it's like mathematically by the British calculation in the metric, it's 16, but the way Netflix expresses it, it's collection 13 for whatever reason. I'm sure there's some backstory on that. This particular batch of bakers was just absolutely charming and wonderful from the beginning. There's been a number of seasons that we've watched where we kind of had a little bit of trouble getting interested in the people, or sort of finding people we were invested in or willing to root for. That was never a problem with this season. Like we felt something for everybody, even if it was like, please go away. like there was no lack of feels for us, some interesting challenges. And of course the signature Great British Baking Show, ridiculous humor and kind of absurdly wholesome feel good version of competition that, I don't know, man, like in the world we're living in right now, the idea that people who are competing with each other ferociously and with dedication can also still like be friends, feels deeply comforting and also very far away at the same time. And so that's been a great watch for us. And if you're not the sort of person who has ever watched it before, or maybe watched it at one point and sort of drifted away, this would be a good one to come to.
Yeah. I almost chose that for my favorite thing.
Yeah. So we're on the same wavelength right there.
I love that show. And this was a good season. Yeah.
It really was.
See, if that was a show that was an American made, they would be doing a crossover with what's it called, Top Gear, where they're trying to bake inside the cars as the cars are driving really fast. And
Yeah,
American shows aren't the same. PBS has one called The Great American Recipe that they've done for a couple of years now, and they've actually successfully channeled a similar vibe.
Oh, that's cool.
It's not as good as The Great British Bake Off, but it's a very enjoyable one, and it's wholesome, and they do become really good friends on that. So I do recommend The Great American Recipe if you can catch it on PBS.
Very cool. All right. Well, we've had a far-flung journey with stops along the way to many places, and when we stop recording, I'm going to have to share my 1926 theory with Beth to see if I'm on target or not.
Please.
But in the meantime, if you want to find out what's going on with 1926, with Mother, with the house, and with everything else, you can check out A House Between Sea and Sky, or also lots of other things from Beth. So Beth, where can people find you and all of your super cool stuff in the now and the near future?
Well, BethCato.com is the place to really find all the links, the huge bibliography, just info on all my books. Just, go there. It's Cato spelled with a C, so it's C-A-T-O. And go there. I have my Bread or Not food blog, posts every Wednesday, mostly desserts and things like that. And from there, you can find my social media links. I'm pretty active on Instagram, Facebook, and on Blue Sky, especially.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us, Beth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay, that's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I like I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.